Marshall and Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment. We have been on a tear with episodes, have brought a lot of new listeners in, so we wanted to take a quick break and do a question and answer session. Q&As are some of our and some of your favorite parts of the show, and we just did not have the ability to answer every single one of these in a normal episode. So we wanted to take the chance to answer as many of them as possible before we get back to our regularly scheduled programming next Tuesday.
That's right. And before we get to those questions, you guys know the deal. Do us a favor, subscribe to therealignment.substack.com. That's our newsletter. That's actually where we'll be taking future questions. So if you have your questions, you can sign up for the newsletter. You can comment at the bottom of it, or you can send in an email and reply to whatever there you get there. Second, make sure that you guys are checking out our bookshop. We have a lot of awesome book recommendations, and we've noticed that you guys are really interested in buying some recent books on finance that I've been posting about on my Instagram page. So we're going to be bringing you even more recommendations in that bookshop. Really helps the show, and you get to buy a book from an independent bookstore during the COVID-19 crisis, which is, of course, very helpful. What am I missing, Marshall? Oh, right. Special shout out to the Lincoln Network who lets us do all of the awesome work that we have here on the podcast. And with that, let's get to it.
Today's question is a fun one, and surprisingly to all of us at Team Realignment, it's one of our most asked ones. It is, you've hinted that it was not easy to choose the theme song for The Realignment, which I love. So my question is, how did you come to choose that song? Tell me the story of how Perezi by Isaac Joel came to be the theme song for The Realignment. Now, for this question, we are bringing a special appearance by our producer, Phil Hegseth, who's been with us since day one. It was entirely his decision, his presentation of the options, so we want to give his perspective on how we chose it.
Yeah, hey guys. I find it hilarious that this is maybe the most asked question that we get. We get it tweeted at us all the time. I'm a huge music person, so from day one when we were starting this, we wanted to find something with a little bit of jazz, with a little bit of pop that'd be fun. I went looking on Soundstripe. If you don't know Soundstripe, it's a good subscription service, $20 a month. Great copyright-free music if you're starting your own project or podcast or YouTube or stream or whatever. Go check it out. Shout out to Soundstripe. But I found four or five different options. Shot it over to Marshall and Sagar. We bat around some ideas, some different artists, and settled on Isaac Joel, just a, I guess, little-known beat maker. He's got a bunch of other really good stuff. You can go check him out on Spotify if you're just vibing for the weekend. and we've talked about changing up the music, maybe trying something new, but you guys seem to love it so much that I don't think we're changing this song up anytime soon.
No, we're not. And it's kind of hilarious. I genuinely don't think I gave it more than 5 minutes of thought. Like, Phil sent me like five links and I was like, yeah, this is fine, just pick this one. Also, congratulations, Phil, you didn't fuck up your Jamie moment, so
there you go.
All right,
and I hope all the listeners like the new question music as well.
Yeah.
The thing that's so funny about that is a lot of people ask us about podcasting. We'll get to a question directly related to that. But the funny thing is, it just happens. We didn't put all this planning in. There wasn't a gallery of serious consideration. We didn't throw it to our girlfriends or wives in Phil's case. We just did it. And that's the approach you should bring to this experience.
100%. Don't get hung up on the small details. Logo, music. Oh, listen, if you have good content, people will come. So people with the shittiest logos and many in this business have great content. So it's not downstream, it's upstream. Okay, here's a good one, and I think encapsulates the thoughts of a lot of you. Hey, love the show. Really varied look at what's going on in the political world without getting bogged down in the muck. Hey, Marshall and Sagar, who are figures that you guys see as potentially inspiring leaders in politics at the moment and going forward? I felt particularly frustrated over the past year because it seems like most of our leadership class are plutocrats, do-nothing panderers, or both. Personally, I'm a Ron DeSantis fanboy, mostly because I think he takes his own responsibility seriously and hasn't been afraid of bold policies. Keep up the good work. This is from Fernarium. What do you think, Marshall?
I'm really more interested in where inspiring leaders are going to come from than necessarily the set of leaders we have here, because you've all heard us say this multiple times. Anyone who participates in the process that exists right now in many ways is going to have their great moments. They're going to have a lot of weak moments. So I want to advise that people pay a lot of attention to media. Once again, there's something that's going on here. Sagar and I talk about this a lot. There's a Nixon-Kennedy debate moment where you're now seeing politicians actually create their own podcasts, do TV more, but in a different way than the typical Fox News or MSNBC hit. So looking at how people use the medium that works there is going to be really fascinating. I don't know if any of y'all have heard of the app Clubhouse, but I got the chance to be in a conversation with Tulsi Gabbard there. What was fascinating to see Tulsi do is Tulsi is in this very open audio app where there's always random people talking. She's also launching a podcast, not a Fox News, MSNBC, or CNN show. That reflects the underlying reality that politicians moving forward are going to want to be the types of people who could do well on Joe Rogan, could build up their own audiences, and aren't necessarily going through big media companies.
Yeah, I just throw it back to our Eric Weinstein episode, where I just think that the current political environment is so poisonous that the people whose time will come and the people who will be called on, it's not their time yet. And so I can't give you a name of somebody who's in the contemporary political discourse, because I think that the contemporary political discourse itself is poisonous. And something I loved that Eric said, which is that we need to be more comfortable with ordering something that's off the menu. We shouldn't just look at the current slate and say, yeah, this is within the realm of possibility. So I think that broadening your horizons and thinking more about what Marshall was saying, the pipeline through which we are going to get our real next generation of leaders is more important than anybody who's even in the political space right now. What's next, Marshall?
This question is a good one for you, Mr. Former White House correspondent. It is from Tefesiv, one of the least pronounceable names anyone's ever given us. Love the podcast. I've learned so much about politics since becoming a regular listener. Question, why is filibuster the hot topic right now? Can you give me a filibuster 101 and explain why we're talking about it so much?
Great question. And it's so funny. We throw these terms around, and I realize we should do a much better job of explaining it. So the filibuster is a Senate rule. It is not, it's prescribed in the Constitution, and that's very key in order for understanding, which is that the Senate governs itself. They agree upon a set of rules. Essentially, what it is it preserves the concept of rights of the minority to object, AKA that you can not pass something through the United States Senate without 60 votes. This was largely, and I want to say largely, not in use before the mid-20th century with the rise of the Southern Democrats, and that's whenever social progressive legislation crashed into it with the Civil Rights Act beginning around the 1940s is really when the filibuster and the rights of the minority began to be discussed and, more importantly, politicized in our current contemporary political discourse. So the reason why that we're talking about it now is that basically Mitch McConnell turned the dial up on the already usage of the filibuster up to like 10,000 under the Obama era, threatening to basically filibuster every Democratic legislative priority, which is why if you look at the Obama administration, its only signature political accomplishment was Obamacare that was passed through budget reconciliation. Budget reconciliation, by contrast, only requires 51 votes, not the required 60. So the reason that we're talking about it is that people want Joe Biden to do something without negotiating with Republicans. That's not possible because we have a 50-50 Senate balance in the Senate. Did I miss anything, Marshall? What did I miss?
Yeah, that's the perfect definition of it. And it's a good example of a perfect issue for demonstrating why the Biden administration is going to be pulled different directions. So on one hand, in the short term, the thinking would go, look, we can do all sorts of things to blow up this filibuster. But there's a decent chance it doesn't happen because of the fact that, like you said, Sagar, the rule exists to preserve minority protection. So if you're a Democrat, you could easily see a world where Republicans could come back into power in 2022 or 2024. So the question you have to ask yourself is the accomplishment of short-term progressive legislation, or in the case of Republicans holding the Senate in 2017, conservative legislation, worth the risk of blowing up the minority protections you have? Because what we really see happen is, once you get rid of those norms, you see an escalation of those policy areas. So that's going to be a major debate going forward.
What are the prospects of marijuana legislation or decriminalization in the next 4 years? I'm guessing that it would need 60 votes in the Senate, but given recent ballot initiatives passing overwhelmingly in red and blue states, is it possible? Could it be done? And will it be done by executive order? What do you think, Marshall?
That is the perfect follow-up question to the legislative filibuster point. But what I would say is this is going to continue to effectively be a state issue. As y'all know, I'm from Oregon, and Oregon has just decriminalized all sorts of drugs ranging from cocaine, crack, meth, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's the type of thing which I don't know as much about drug policy, so I'm not going to comment on the wisdom of the law there. But the point is that is an issue which is getting resolved at the state. I do not think the Biden administration or the Democratic Senate is going to prioritize drug decriminalization or legalization, especially over the next 2 years. There's just too many other issues, and it's very low down the actual wish list for the Democratic side. What I would say will probably happen, and this is why you're right, listener, to bring up the executive branch through executive orders, is they are not going to enforce federal marijuana or federal drug laws to the same degree that, for example, the Trump administration did under Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who was a noted anti-drug legalization figure. What do you think, Sagar?
Yeah, and this is where our filibuster answer really becomes key. I don't see it passing in the Senate under Biden, although Chuck Schumer and a few others have recently sponsored some stuff. But again, 60 votes is just such a high bar in order to hit something on this. Whether it be done on an executive order, so legalization, I mean, this is the weird thing around the laws, which is that, I mean, we already basically live in a system where drugs are legal in some form. Like the DEA, by right, could go in and storm in to the state of Colorado and, like, seize the assets from these marijuana shops, but they're just not going to do that because they're respecting the will of Colorado voters. I think it'll be interesting as we go forward, because I think it's probably going to be a more federalist approach where it'll probably be legal in like half states and probably be illegal on half states. And then when it comes to legalization, it will be the terms of legalization itself will be different. So, for example, like in Colorado, weed is legal, but in the city of Denver, psychedelics are legal. So in the state of Oregon, all drugs are decriminalized. So I think that it will be gradations. And, you know, look, I mean, we lived in the federalist system. Maybe it's not such a bad thing. You know, if we could see how it works out in Oregon and how it works out in a few other states, and maybe we can see whether it works on a national level from there. But I don't see anything changing on the macro picture in quite some time.
Now, normally we do the Q&A, like a Q&A, but I want to interview you about something real quick, because we probably edited it out, but when we were talking about decriminalization, you referred to it as legalization in the state of Oregon. So what are your thoughts, Sagar, on the difference between legalization and decriminalization?
Yeah, I think it's actually really important, because legalization is basically a government stamp of approval that something is good. And you can throw alcohol at me all you want, but I mean, the truth is alcohol has been part of the Western civilization now for 5,000 years, and it's just fundamentally different. So whenever we talk about decriminalization and legalizations, I do think it is important. And whenever we talk also about that, it's the decriminalization part is actually where I have difficulty, because I don't think that people should be thrown in jail for possessing small amounts of marijuana or other drugs. But I think that drug dealers, especially in drug cartels and others, are terrible people, and I want to see the full force of the law that are thrown at them, especially given how much it's intertwined with Mexican gangs and the Chinese and the manufacture of fentanyl and just the sheer amount of thousands of people that we've lost to heroin and more in the last couple of years. So I have very complicated feelings whenever it comes to the matter. And yeah, and that's why I think that the decriminalization thing, I mean, look, I have no idea. I'm sure that most of the people listening to this podcast think I'm like some authoritarian nut job, but I just legitimately am not going to believe that it is a good thing in order to let people shoot heroin indiscriminately in the streets of Portland. And I just don't see any way that that works out. We'll see. But I very much fear for the lives of a lot of the people who are horribly hooked on these substances. And I fear for the eventual fallout from the lack of policing. And worst of all, I know that this is the greatest boon to the Mexican drug cartels that's ever existed. So those are kind of my complicated feelings on the matter.
Here's our next question. Do you guys think if China / the Chinese Communist Party invaded or conducted a hostile takeover of Taiwan, while the U.S. is in a state of internal turmoil and division, that a Biden administration would act resolutely to defend Taiwan? Do you think Republicans would unite behind a Democratic government to act decisively?
That's a great question, man. That's a very difficult one. I just don't know. I honestly, my gut says is that we would do something, but in terms of full-scale war, I mean, look, you're really going to go to war over the island of Taiwan, which is, you know, X amount of miles away from China, and risk everything in a full-blown nuclear conflict? I don't see it. That being said, the credible nuclear deterrent and the defense pacts and more that we have with Taiwan make it a lot less likely that China would do that too. But it's such like an extreme scenario that I'm not even sure if it's like useful to your point. The more useful thing that I think you're talking about, which is like, okay, yesterday I actually just saw this. The Chinese, you know, simulated a all-out attack on a U.S. aircraft carrier in broad daylight as a clear signal. Will the Biden administration run a carrier through the South China Sea in response? Those are more of like the geostrategic questions that I think you should be asking, where like, I don't know the answer to that yet. What do you think, Marshall?
It's interesting because if there's one area where you and I have been the most positive on the Biden administration, it's 100% been the fact that they have selected serious center left China hawks to come into the administration. It would have been the easiest thing in the world for the Biden folks to come in and say, we're dumping every single thing Trump did. We are going to over-focus on Russia because he didn't focus enough on Russia and was obsessed with China. But instead, they've actually brought in serious people who've thought about this in a really strong way. And it's a reflection of the fact that in many ways, despite what we would articulate as many failures of Trump's presidency, the one long-term historical reality that really matters here is going to be the fact he turned thing against China. Quick digression, Sagar. I'm thinking about my favorite story from your White House correspondent days when you asked Trump what he was going to be known for in the history books. The guess that you and I make is the China point, but can you tell the audience what his answer to you was?
Yeah, and he said veteran's choice. And I remember being like, you know, I'm going to go out on a limb and say that's just not it. But yeah, like he's like, I don't know what we've done for our vets. And I was like looking at this portrait of Andrew Jackson, which he had in the Oval Office. And I was like, yeah, you know, I just don't think so. I was like, you think you're going to be remembered a lot more like him than anything for about Veterans Choice. But hey, that's just me. Okay, here's the next one. Question. Do you guys see the MAGA movement and populism as the same thing? Or are there differences? And what may those differences be? That's a great question. What do you think, Marshall?
It's a great question because it helps us define terms that get thrown around a lot and lead to a lot of confusion from left, right, and center about what this show is, what our perspectives are, and basically everything else under the sun. So let's start. Populism is a tactic. Populism is not an ideology. You can be a neoliberal populist. I can imagine a world where everyone lives in the Soviet Union and it's the 70s. Everything's communistic, there's no form of market freedom, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you have a person say, look at these elites who run the Soviet state. They make you live in apartments, they send you to the gulag, you can't buy things, they won't let you get the blue jeans that you want. We need to enact changes to do this, this, and that. That's populism. Nothing is more annoying.
You're describing the Russian populist revolution, by the way.
Yeah, exactly, right? Like, nothing is more annoying than when people say, right populism is fake because it doesn't support Medicare for all. Everyone knows that populism believes in a specific form of single-payer healthcare as implemented through a unique usage of the hospital system. No. So populism could basically be anything. Because the key thing here, and here's the second part of the answer, and I like your distinction between MAGA and populism, is you can be entirely MAGA, use populist rhetoric, but also be entirely down for the most right neoliberal traditional conservative approach to everything. You could be the type of person who says, I think the elites in DC are terrible. We need to drain the swamp. We need to overthrow them, but then come in and also support tax cuts, also come in and support traditional Republican policies, because the key thing is, it's a tactic. It is not a policy plank.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And this, I hope we drive this home a million times. Populism is a political vehicle and a tactic. It can mean anything to anyone. It's value neutral, just like realignments. Those are not something which come with specific policies. And speaking of things that don't come with specific policies, the MAGA movement. Look, the MAGA movement is basically just about Trump and cultural grievance, but it's mostly about Trump. So, for example, Marjorie Taylor Greene, who is like as MAGA as it gets, is talking about how she will not fund blue state bailouts. So, is it a populist position to be against state and local bailouts, which is actually supported by 80% of people? No. What we're talking there is about cultural grievance. And look, maybe even you guys like agree with that, disagree. That's fine. You write in. I can explain it in a different question. But more what I'm pointing to is that MAGA is about Trump and it is about culture. At its very core, the idea that it currently is represented in some sort of policy consensus around trade or immigration or any of that, maybe on immigration more than any of the other things. But I think to understand it at its core is to look at some of its most ardent defenders, especially in 2020. And that's why I like to point to those boat parades. And it's hilarious because I used to make fun of Trump for pointing to the boat parades as like why he was doing really well. But I've actually come to understand that the boat parade is the heart and soul of Trumpism, which was they're basically just like traditional Republicans who voted Republican for the last like 40 years. And they live in a suburb or any other area. They're upwardly mobile, more like the small business class. It's just that Trump gave them an excuse to be a lot more boorish. And that's what I actually think most of MAGA boiled down to in the 2020 election. And look, it's a pretty popular force. It won 75 million votes. Like, don't get me wrong, but just try to understand that there were populist elements of the MAGA movement, but MAGA itself is not necessarily populist, as evidenced by some of the extraordinarily unpopular things like trying to repeal Obamacare and cutting taxes that Trump did when he was in office.
And the key thing here, and this goes to another thing that people push back on, is people were really excited in early 2020 when it looked like Trump was the nominee, but when it also looked like Bernie was going to be the nominee, because they saw something like, look, there's a populist coalition that is rising, wink, wink at Sagar, mm-hmm. of course, with show titles, but is rising and is going to come in and just upend the establishment. That didn't happen. Now, that didn't happen because even though Bernie and Trump both use populist rhetoric, their actual objectives are completely different. And in many ways, Sagar, can you think of an example of where the left and right populists actually completely intersect, other than checks? But this is what's complicated too.
Yeah.
Right. So like this is me referring to Senator Josh Hawley and Senator Bernie Sanders a few weeks ago. But the thing that's frustrating there too is I suspect, and correct me if I'm wrong, in many cases, a lot of the right populists and even the left populists would still choose not to work together on those issues because they would prioritize culture war issues over them.
Well, I mean, we got a perfect example, right? It was whenever people thought that Robinhood had shut things down at the behest of Wall Street instead of the capital requirements thing, AOC and Ted Cruz was like, you're right, AOC, what's going on with Robinhood is bad. And she's like, I'm not going to work with you because you incited the riots. So like, I mean, there you go, right? Like, she was basically like, I'm not going to choose to work with you. You could say what you want about that. I think it's pretty, you know, whatever, making yourself the story. But that goes to show what the ultimate barrier to this is always going to be. So I just think it's really important to understand. And you could say this about Bernie, too. Like, I hope you Bernie people out there aren't just, like, nodding your head and be like, yeah, like, there's a difference between MAGA and populism, like, as in, like, all Bernie was populist. It's like, no, Bernie believed in plenty of non-populist things and was, in many ways, like, a deeply, or at least hinting at him, but much of his campaign was captured by the identitarian left, which is the opposite of populism. Some of his proposals and some of the things that he did were themselves populist. So there's no such thing really as just like populism incarnate in any politician, especially in a two-party system. I just think it's important to remember that. Okay, next question.
So this question is from Eric Schiedler, and Eric just notes that he actually sent this question in a while ago. It fell through the cracks, so he re-upped it. So in all seriousness, thank you, Eric. I mean that totally seriously. Please send us a follow-up if we did not get to your question from August and September. We generally want to answer as many of these as possible, and sometimes they fall through the bit. Another quick thing about Eric, he is actually part of one of our Gen X listener set. You will not be forgotten. So Eric's question is the following. Where does the debate over abortion fit into the broader realignment framework? The key thing to understand about this question is Eric is the executive director of the Pro-Life Action League. And I want to say something about this first. Sagar and I really like to avoid focusing on culture war issues on the show. You've all noticed this because to the point about the recent conversation with Senator Hawley, Senator Sanders, AOC, etc., it hampers what we're trying to build here, but I do appreciate the way Eric framed the actual question because it is very important. What do you think, Sagar?
Yeah, you know, it's a good question. And look, I'll just put on my like purely analytical hat. It basically is the one area issue that incarnate that where this all breaks down. So a Democratic Party that wants to win in the South, despite what AOC and those people tried to tell you whenever it came to like Jessica Cisneros against Henry Cuellar, there's a Democratic governor down in the South who actually does pretty well. His name is John Bel Edwards, but he's the pro-life governor of Louisiana. And they basically pretend that he doesn't exist, even though he actually won two elections straight. And then on the right, there was this governor. He was the most popular governor in the entire country. In any other circumstance, he would have been future of the party. He was Hispanic. He governed in a conservative way. Oh, but he was pro-choice. So there you go. His name was Brian Sandoval. So I just laid out two people who have zero future in their national political parties, despite being able to win in different ways. Anybody substantively interested in a realignment actually would look at those two people for being like, hey, how do exactly I do something or pull this off? So that just goes to show you how central the issue of abortion actually is to both of the parties, especially as tests and where a lot of this stuff breaks down. I mean, Bernie Sanders endorsed a pro-life Democrat as recently as 2017, and which I respect him for because he was like, listen, the guy's pro-union and I'm pro-union, and that's something that I want to push forward. Guess what he apologized for in 2020? So there you go. What do you think, Marshall?
That's the perfect way to articulate it. Let's go back to our Josh Hawley example before anything relating to January 6th. The thing that I always thought when it came to the whole left-right alliance thing was my genuine view was any serious legislative project that brought in populist conservative senators, members of Congress, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, would have to reflect the fact that these members are all pretty much pro-life and very seriously so. So given that reality, I always saw the choice that center-left and left-wing Democrats are going to have to make is, do we work with someone who is socially conservative and vice versa from the other direction? And what I just strongly believe is the bases of both parties would not accept the decision to work with people who are in the opposite of those culture war issues. Part of the reason why Bernie pivoted on the 2017 endorsement was there's no actual base of the Democratic Party that was rewarding for that. Yep. Maybe I'm missing something because I don't read Jacobin, but I don't think Jacobin was writing pieces about how Bernie was betraying the left populist movement, because an analysis of the situation would say that, hey, look, during the height of FDR, during the height of progressive era politics, a lot of these people were very socially conservative. It actually didn't used to be true that economic progressivism, Marxism, et cetera, was automatically aligned with left social policy. So that's what you're really seeing there. And the broader point to the whole realignment discussion, to answer Eric's question, would basically be to sum this up as it serves as a firewall between a rapid shift in American politics. Abortion and the unresolvable nature of the debate, unlike every other social issue, gay marriage, changing. LGBTQ plus issues, changing. President Biden overturned trans members of the military. There's almost no chance that a Republican administration in 2024 or 2028 goes back on that. Don't ask, don't tell. It's over. Abortion is going to stick there. I genuinely think abortion is basically going to be around 50-50 for both sides. When one side comes into office, whichever position they hold will get a little less popular. So I think what will happen under Biden is abortion will become a little less popular. Same thing with Trump when it was in office, but it's basically going to stay stagnant. And what that means is, as as much as you innovate, as much as you come up with new policies, you're going to run into the fact that abortion is an issue which affects the urban-rural divide. It's the perfect encapsulation of the difference between working class, non-college educated people and college and graduate school educated folks. It's always going to serve as that barrier there.
Yeah. And that's just something that we have to live with. Next question from Excelion the Great. My question is this: when faced with news and developments enrage you, such as lack of government being able to do basic policy, such as stimulus checks, what do you do so that your anger doesn't lead to destructive pathways? How does an ever increasingly angering population deal with these problems constructively? What do you think, Marshall?
I'm disappointed that you did not reference the Zune. Quick context, in the actual response, Excelion references his love of the Zune, and I'm a huge Microsoft product fan, so I don't have a Mac. I'm using a Surface keyboard, so I know there's a lot of you Microsoft listeners there. Please write in and I will give you a special shout out. We have to stick together. But no, to the actual question here and anger and feeling that, I think what you have to do is reflect on the past. You need to reflect on the fact that this is going to be a really tough decade on 15 different levels. And this is not going to be a decade where we're going to be sated or where all of our concerns are going to be addressed. It's basically a minimum viable product. What do we need to actually live? Which from my perspective means we need to actually have a good China policy. We need to actually have vaccines, and we need to make sure that there are checks and a stimulus package that helps working and poor people get through this real tragedy. And we do need support for small businesses that I think has been a huge gap in the way that state and local governments have approached this. That's my objective. If we can hit those points in the next few years, I'll be happy. But I think if you approach this through the perspective of, I'm so angry at the state of the world and I want all my problems to be fixed, it's just not going to be there for you.
Yeah, it's a really tough question. And look, I mean, the problem is that there is a lot of people who are feeding off of this nihilism and are leading people in bad directions. And this is something I talked a lot about on my show Rising today and when it came to GameStop, which is that the GameStop story is not about the Redditors or whatever. What it was is about a populace, a lot of people who are young, my age, a lot of them even younger, who are like, hey, I feel like the system is fundamentally unfair. As in, I watched these people get bailed out in 2008 and they're richer than ever. And I live with my parents, or I live in a really small place, or I really want to propose to my girlfriend, but I can't afford it. Or I really want to have a kid, but I can't afford it. Or I want to buy a car, but I have to buy something used. Like, that is being channeled unironically by a lot of people online into being like, yeah, that's why we need to loosen the restrictions on day trading and make it possible so that we can day trade all day. And then we can take on the guys at the top. No, that's not the answer. The answer is that we need a better and more equitable society, and that we need more regulation. And more importantly, that we need like things like $2,000 checks and better services. So that's not a sexy question, and you're not necessarily going to get any of that. But what I would say is go and read about how social change in America happens. It usually happens where you have an untenable or a ridiculous situation similar to where we're in right now. And like Marshall said, it's to be slow. You have to be happy with like very marginal changes on the sides. And then all of a sudden, if you keep it up, you keep up pressure, more importantly, you stay engaged, and more importantly, don't lose faith, then 10 or 15 years from now, there'll be some precipitating event and everything will change. That's just how things work here. It's a democratic process. It's incredibly annoying, but it's not something where you should just give in to nihilism, because there are a lot of people who are looking to profit from nihilism. And I think that that's 10 times worse than having a little bit of faith in the government's ability to do something.
Last but not least, we will finish with a 2024 question from I Freaking Love This 4567. Thanks for the weekly shows that are getting me through a cold, boring January in New York City. Quick side / editorial note. The last thing Sagar and I did before lockdowns, we went to New York for a Rising show. Yes. So I have a special place in my heart for New York in the winter. We really can't wait to be back up there. Events, all those sort of things when everything's open again. So we're looking forward to doing that. But let's get to the actual question. My question is, looking at whatever 2024 may be, is there any chance for Tulsi Gabbard to switch parties and have a realistic shot at being the GOP candidate versus Kamala? I guess I imagine her being able to run a similar campaign to Trump 2016's in terms of being against the Washington status quo and ending foreign wars abroad, as well as being for curbing the power and influence of big tech companies, which feels like the next big issue, at least on the GOP side.
That's a great question, but I'll just reference one we just had. She's pro-choice. It's not going to happen. She could never win a GOP nomination because she's pro-choice. She's actually against like second and third trimester abortion, which puts her pretty squarely in the middle of politics, but that's not good enough for a lot of people who are within the GOP base. And look, I care about all those things that you just laid out. I care about them very deeply, but you need to understand the actual makeup and composite nature of the Republican electorate if you're going to have political analysis there. And she's just not going, she never could be a GOP nominee in 2024.
The key thing here is I could definitely see Tulsi as a defense secretary,
yep,
or a position which isn't directly in line for the presidency in that case. There was actually a lot of talk about how in the early Trump administration, they were huge fans of her. So it's worth thinking about that. But yes, unless there was a pretty sweeping change on her approach to social conservative issues, I wouldn't really see that happening. And there's just going to be a huge gap in the ability to transition those things together there. Tulsi's incredibly young. If I'm her, there's almost no way my only thing I'm thinking about is what's going to happen in 2024. And one quick thing, which we should not undercount, Joe Biden has said he's running in 2024. That should not be discounted. I think the thing, yep, that we could definitely all agree is this isn't August where there's a serious question. And I don't think it was that serious of a question. A lot of it was bad faith of whether Joe Biden would be physically and mentally present. Biden's president. And I think there's a strong chance that he runs again. And I think he does want to run again. So don't just automatically assume that anything is going to be Kamala in 2024.
Completely agree with that. And with that, guys, it's been really great taking your questions. I always love doing one of these episodes. I'm glad maybe some of our newer listeners get to know us. Make sure you guys send in your questions to therealignment.substack.com. Go there and sign up for our newsletter. You can reply and ask us questions there.
And the key thing here, everyone, is thank you so much for getting us to the current ratings level we are at. We think the algorithm has been sated. We appreciate it. Obviously, we'll be back roughly once a month with another push for more ratings, but we really appreciate it. We want the questions to keep on coming, even if they're not just through a rating. Last but not least, huge thank you to Lincoln Network. We can't wait to see you guys next week.